you very much for this terrific introduction. I didn't know what a keynote talk was until I looked it up at a rather late stage in Merriam-Webster, and I gather some key themes are supposed to be thrown out in this talk. So I managed to find a few. They're probably completely irrelevant, but I felt rather aggressive. So I'm going to be rather rude, but not to or about any of you, but about dear absent friends. So this is perhaps I should conceal names, but... OK. No. This workshop has gone under two titles which are not identical. The first title, the one under which I was invited to join the workshop, was Religion and Identity. I'm not sure what religion is. The word is a shorthand for any number of different things. Whatever's meant by religion, however, it's undoubtedly an ingredient of many identities, though since people have multiple identities and since in different people those identities and their constituents are more or less present to their consciousness and consciously harmonised or in tension, and since religion, whatever form it takes, may as an ingredient of an identity be active, passive, focal or peripheral, I feel that the binary religion and identity is to some extent begging a question or asking a leading question. Does that matter? No, you might say, this is a workshop after all, and we're here to hammer away at ideas from all angles, so the more provocative the title, the better. The official title of the workshop, Chosen Peoples, I abbreviate, is something else again, however. Being, like most medievalists, or at any rate most Middle East medievalists, theoretically naive, it wasn't until I'd done a bit of digging that I found out its genealogy. The parent of the apparently influential idea that a sense of nationhood grows out of a belief in ethnic election, Anthony D. Smith, presented the theory or premise or assertion as a model applicable from remote antiquity to the present, from the Bible to Daesh, as we might say, briskly and without much detailed infill in his inaugural lecture at the LSE in 1991, entitled Chosen Peoples, Why Ethnic Groups Survive. The basis of Smith's model is ethnic community, defined thus by him. We can now define an ethnic community, or ethne, as a named human group claiming a homeland and sharing myths of common ancestry, historical memories, and a distinct culture. None of which seems to me unproblematic if you try to apply it to any particular instance. But Smith goes on to refine the definition thus. Yet what is even more important for ethnic survival is to cultivate a myth of ethnic election. I.e., he proposes that what he calls ethnic groups survive because they think of themselves as chosen people. On the surface, taken casually, this sounds persuasive. We might feel some disquiet at the word ethnic, but the really problematic word is survival. Professor Smith is a historical sociologist. I have no objection to the parts of his definition that concern myth and seem to point to an ideal of social memory. The idea of social memory is a vital corrective to academic introspection and to the idea that group identities are formed by what scholarship says really happened, rather than by what the groups themselves think happened or ought to have happened. Where I find myself taken aback is when I come up against Professor Smith's airy way with history, scholarly or imagined, and his idea of survival, and by implication, continuity. Listen to this. We need not dwell at length on the powerful myths of election that have surfaced periodically among the Arabs and their kingdoms, notably during the Islamic conquests, about which he seems to think that there's solid first-hand information. Fred Donner may wish to comment. And in the period of the Crusades, about which we do have first-hand information, but it doesn't throw up myths of election and those kings who are urged in the Arabic, but not necessarily Arab sources, to oppose the Crusaders are notably not Arabs. In some ways, Islamic allegiance has added a crusading fervour. Here, Smith's leap across periods and possibly jokey transfer of epithets is underpinned by a reference to the layperson's favourite Middle East historian, Bernard Lewis. I need hardly tell you... need hardly tell you that even in 1991, this sort of essentialism, innocent of any reference to and presumably knowledge of any primary sources, well might Professor Smith disclaim the wish to dwell upon them, was not good history. Consequently, one would hope that the influence of his theory would be limited to non-specialists, or that specialists in any of the fields over which Professor Smith's survey roved so widely would engage with it critically rather than welcoming it as a blueprint or a legitimation. So I was taken aback yet again when the source that had given me the lead to Anthony Smith's all-enveloping theory of chosen peoples, a fellow Middle East medievalist, seemed to take the theory as a given and apply it in much the same source-light way. I'll come back to this particular case in just a moment. Before getting into detail, though, I'd like to glance back at theory and at principles. The first principle for academics is academic freedom. As academics, we're in an ambivalent position vis-à-vis authority. If authority listens to us, we might side with it. If it ignores us, we criticise it. In any case, we don't, in theory, let it tell us what to do. One of the things authority wants Oxford academics to do now is apply an anti-terrorist protocol called PREVENT. We are, by and large, against this protocol, which is complicated and nebulous, because it seems to inhibit free thought and free expression and requires us to report any speeches or activities that we think might be suspect from the point of view of anti-terrorism security. In the light of PREVENT, I think that the Bible to Daesh chosen peoples version of this workshop's title is rather worrying. It's provocative and eye-catching within our academic community and may well have caught the attention of the wider social media. What kind of message does it convey? Does it challenge PREVENT or does it rather pander to it? If we go back to what Professor Smith claimed for his theory of chosen peoples, it appears to put Daesh in the lineage of antiquity, which is the lineage that Daesh claims for itself. It appears to make claims of historical and cultural continuity for Daesh, which Daesh is unable to make coherently for itself. In spite of having asked me and Fred Donner to give keynote talks, in my case at least before the chosen peoples theme of the workshop had been announced, talks which may be expected to challenge Daesh's claims to be a return to authenticity, the eye-catching headline title throws a mantle of antiquity over Daesh with an airy ahistoricity worthy of Professor Smith himself. Let me get back to the particular case that I referred to just now, the one that put me on to Anthony Smith and his theory, and which shows why, merely on the level of method, I think that the Smith theory is mischievous. I'll be obliged to criticise a colleague and a friend, which is something that in the backwaters of medieval Arabic studies I rarely do, but here I think it has to be done. What I'm going to criticise isn't mischievous in itself, but it's something that non-specialists may well find it convenient to quote, and it's simply not adequate scholarship and should not be used to bolster large theories or claims. I'm talking of a well-received monograph that came out in 2013 and takes a timely and welcome Iranian slant on the Arabic language sources for the Islamic conquests of the 7th century AD and their aftermath. Although it's unnecessary for me to do so, I'll just remind you that these Arabic language sources are ethnically as Arab as medieval Latin sources are Roman on the whole. The monograph is Sarah Byrne-Savant's The New Muslims, Post-Conquest Iran, Tradition, Memory, and Conversion. It is largely informed by Anthony Smith's theory of chosen people, for which it does indeed offer some support in its discussion of genealogies linking the Holy Family of Islam to the Sasanian royal house, whose last daughter, by the fortunes of war, is supposed to have united the blood of her ancestors with that of the Prophet Muhammad's nephew. It's not the focus on the well-known and widespread device of idealized genealogies that is problematic, but rather the reliance on Anthony Smith as a legitimating authority, which gives rise to such vague and unsupported, indeed unsupportable statements as the following, which are eminently quotable and might sound like just the thing to anyone trying to pursue themes in medieval history across cultural and linguistic frontiers. I quote, "From an early date, the Arabs often espoused a missionary sense of chosenness when they sought new converts, first among other Arabs and then among their neighbours. Arabic literature is filled with claims representing them as a people of religion set apart from others. A common identity documented through tribal genealogies was nurtured, and it was also their election that made Arabs out of former non-Arabs." I'm probably getting this wrong, but someone in, I think, Hollywood once famously said that every word that someone else, I think also in Hollywood, said was a lie, including "and." And I have to say that the criticism applies to this quotation, insofar as everything that it says is A, unsupported by any references to primary or secondary sources, and B, wrong or at best inaccurate in substance, hence dodgy in inference, although there's no intention to deceive. But it sounds coherent and authoritative, and I dare say anyone who didn't know the sources might think this passage was a sound summary of what can be gathered from them, with its apparently neutral temporal markers of cause and effect, early, often, first, then, supporting the rhetorical intensifiers of the narrative, espoused, sought, filled, documented, nurtured, a narrative which I think is undocumented on every point, as I've already said. Problematic terms or phrases are Arabs, missionary sense, seeking converts, other Arabs and neighbours, Arabic literature, tribal genealogies regarded as documentation, the making of Arabs out of former non-Arabs, and the idea that election was the way in which a transformation of identity or substance was effected. The identity in question might be Arab or might be Muslim, and this isn't entered into in this passage, although it's key to its subjacent argument and to that of the monograph. There's a worrying lack of temporality and specific context here in this summarising passage and throughout the monograph. I've myself cursorily read, consulted, or investigated more in more depth at least some of the sources invoked by the author and others not referred to, and I don't think that their overriding message is one of the election of chosen peoples. Furthermore, there are puzzling, ambiguous messages that the sources carry and sometimes underline explicitly that should surely be mentioned alongside any messages that we would like to single out for our own purposes. Tomorrow, Fred Donner will do a very much better job than I could of explaining what's involved in using Arabic language sources critically for trying to understand the first three or four centuries of Muslim rule in the Middle East. What I would rather do now is put on the table some key cultural concepts and problems that are familiar to Middle East medievalists, but may not be familiar across cultural fields. And I'd also like, going back to my objection to the new appellation of this workshop, Chosen Peoples from the Bible to Daesh, to make a point about ways of doing and signposting cross-cultural and cross-disciplinary engagement. The final message of the one and only God to mankind was made in Arabic, the Quran says, which might lead us to suppose that Arab and Muslim are synonymous. But as you know, they never were and never have been. Not least because Arabs in Iraq and Syria were Jews and Christians before Islam and have remained so in significant numbers for centuries until now, which is one of the thinking points that medieval Muslims had to ponder on. Then there was the fact that the imagined ethnies, to use Anthony Smith's term, of pre-Islamic Arabia were not all Arabs. Remember that Arabia as a subcontinent is larger than India and had and has a culturally and linguistically diverse population. And another complicating fact is that pre-Islamic Arabs, the grandparents and parents of Muhammad and his followers, and subsequently the identity bearers of their Muslim descendants, when they were not Jews or Christians and therefore little less than Muslims, embodied in their wonderful poetry, which is the Homer and Hesiod of Arabic-speaking cultures, a compelling ethical, aesthetic, and imaginative system that could never be shaken off. And finally, non-Arab Muslims, that's to say most medieval Muslims, were fascinated by this literary legacy and indeed were instrumental as scholars in institutionalizing it, even if they disputed Arabness as a title to claims of superiority. This dispute, known as Shu'biyya, ethnic contention, once occupied a key place in Western scholarship, out of proportion to its meagre representation in the almost exclusively literary sources, because it chimed in with the gamut of 20th century political preoccupations. Its actual historical significance seems to be that it stimulated reflection on language, thought, and expression as a means of salvation for Muslims. Arabic was, for a while, the language of salvation. But it wasn't necessary, or often indeed possible, to be an Arab to join the Arabic linguistic community. Nor indeed was it even necessary to be a Muslim to be part of an Arabic-speaking culture or writing culture that could produce salvific utterances and ideas. And before the end of four centuries, the Arabic language had ceased to be the sole necessary bearer of Muslim culture. Arabic language and literature, in all the complexities just outlined, were the bearers not just of religious, but also of social and no less political culture. And their role in building and maintaining bureaucracies and supplying warlords and dynasts with administrations and ministers, and literate people with a model of civil society and a forum of civilized interaction, is a focus of current scholarship. This role was informed by Persian culture from the beginning of Muslim rule in the Middle East, and Persian, having mysteriously disappeared as a written language after the Islamic conquests, equally mysteriously re-emerged as the language of an authoritative literature 400 years later, and maintained its cultural sway ever after. After, I hope, complicating the picture a bit with these points, which may be general knowledge, but which nevertheless bear repeating, I should like to end on two further general points, one concerning genealogy, the other about methodology. In the course of the 19th and early 20th centuries, industrially based globalized capitalism, technology and finance, and the power of European arms and market forces had a sharp impact, as you know, on political thinking in the Middle East and on the less developed world generally. Pan-Arabism and pan-Islamism were two ideas developed by the international Muslim intelligentsia in response to British and French imperialism. Another not unrelated response that more frankly acknowledged the influence of social Darwinism was secularist thinking about how to stimulate economic and social development so as to resist European encroachments. The nation-states established by the post-World War I settlements were something that ideologues of these varied secular and religious stamps had to adapt their thinking to. Subsequent failed states, warlordism and Daesh stand in direct succession to these and to more recent local and global thinking and developments on the ground, and not to putative early or bookish medieval ideas of divine election. We all know this, but I think we should try to avoid any shorthand that might give credence to the full medievalism enlisted by violent Islamists. Speaking of bookishness, perhaps the most important point to make in concluding is that we should always be aware of the limitations of our sources, whatever they are. We always need to remember some key caveats of anthropology. Sources may say one thing but mean another, or many others. For Middle East scholars, and particularly Middle East medievalists, it's always salutary to revisit a classic of the 1980s, Michael Gilsonen's Recognizing Islam. He describes how, in remote South Arabia in 1959, having been taken under the wing of two young sharifs, holy men who progressed through the streets in their traditional robes to general reverence and had their hands kissed even by a modern young student, he thought he'd found the key to the semiotics of Islam. Far from it. Once inside their own house, the sharifs threw off their robes and fetched out the gramophone and the whiskey, while the reverend student subsequently declared himself a rampant secularist looking forward to the day when sharifs would be strung up. Gilson and comments, groups and individuals using the same signs and codes but seeing events in quite different ways, concealed significances in social life and complex relations to wider historical events. Worth remembering since those of us who are medievalists have a tendency to seek one overriding way of reading signs and texts. Gilsonen goes on to detail the extent of the divergences between signs and meanings that to outsiders schooled to look for particular things in particular ways are invisible. He reminds us rightly that orthodoxies based solely on text scholarship exclude vast and determinate fields of meaning. And here I can only agree with Gilsonen that 20th century orthodoxies concerning Islam have been as much a product of Western text scholarship as of the Muslim clerisy. Gilsonen's warning of nearly 40 years ago bears repeating. Contemporary events are dangerous guides to thought. Islam has become so much of a preoccupation of Western politics and media that we're tempted to think of it as a single, unitary and all-determining object, a thing out there with a will of its own. Fit where they touch theories like Anthony Smith's theory of chosen people reinforce the tendency to look for a single narrative and need wary handling. And I wonder how much this particular theory really contributes to dialogue. However, none of the papers I've heard today has had any truck with the Smith theory, but rather all of them, in masterly fashion, have unpicked it and shown a fascinating variety of ways in which it does not apply.